am Kelly Forden, and I'm happy to welcome Joseph Harris to the podcast today. His new book, You're in the Wrong Place, is a Michigan Notable book this year, and it's published by Wayne State University Press. And we're going to be talking about the first story in the book, which is called Jack, or Would You Rather? Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly. I'm really excited to be here.
So I just wanted to start with sort of an overview of the book as a whole and sort of the themes that you're talking about in the book before we delve into the story.
I think overall, obviously, the main theme is the recession in Detroit. And I think from what I defined its duration as, which is from 2008 to 2015, and centers around either former employees of this one specific fabricating shop, Dynamic Fabricating, which is located on the east side of Ferndale, and how the former employees or the people that are related to them, or I think that have had come into contact with them in some way, kind of dealing with the loss of their livelihoods, the loss of their imagined futures, and trying to deal with this present that in, I guess, the heart of the book doesn't really seem like it's going to end. I think mainly from my perspective, it's about trying to make your own meaning within a economic and religious system that is indifferent to you.
I just noticed that you mentioned the religious system. Can you unpack that a little bit more for us?
Oh yeah, of course. I think religion is definitely a big undercurrent in the book. A lot of the characters are Catholic. A lot of them are, I think, Christian in some way, or are in the process of leaving Christianity or have left it. And I think one of the things that I was attempting to cover there was in religion, I think Catholicism in particular is always trying to posit that the world that we live in right now, I guess the living world, is not the authentic world, and that this world is a trial to prepare you for the real world when you die. And I think that's comforting when you are in a situation like I think a lot of the characters are, where life is incredibly difficult and incredibly frustrating, and there doesn't really seem to be many reasons or possibilities for happiness. So that's a very attractive proposition, thinking that, you know, there is another world where your real life awaits you. But if you stop believing that, then you're kind of forced to confront the material realities of your life. And for me, that was the most interesting thing to explore, was kind of this view of materiality, I guess, as its own religion, but saying that this is all that there is and you have to create your own life. And if you don't necessarily have the economic ability to improve your own life, then you're kind of left to question everything else, including kind of your own identity.
And that's a point that Jess brings up in this story. So when we get into it, I guess we can talk more about materialism. So I wanted to talk about the locations, because I'm not as familiar with Ferndale as I am with other parts of Detroit. So are all of these actual locations, like Katie's Bar and some of the other places that come up here?
Yeah. So Katie's Bar is kind of loosely based on Ye Olde Saloon in Royal Oak, which is my favorite bar. And I had so many conversations with so many people there while I was writing this. And, you know, some of those ideas that I was thinking of or conversations I had did wind up in the book in one form or another. And Katie's is named after my friend Katie Duncan, who passed away a few years ago. So that was kind of like my way to sneak that in there. A literal place for the physical location of it would be the stop spot. I think it's called like Second Base now. And that is on 9 Mile, I want to say maybe like a quarter mile past Hilton on the east side of Ferndale. So that's what I was thinking in terms of like the physical location of that place. But I guess, yeah, I wanted to kind of like recreate this bar that I knew so well and spent so much time in, and use it as kind of like this central place where all the characters could gather, especially at the beginning and end of the book.
So before we get into talking directly about the story, I was just curious about, I'm always curious about the order in which stories are written, especially when they're interconnected stories. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about the ordering here?
Absolutely. In its original form, I think when I was first writing it before I went to Minnesota and kind of had the idea to turn it into the form it is now, it was going to be a bunch of like fictional interviews with just Detroiters who were living through the recession. And, you know, some of the classes I took there in it, the suggestion of my professors was, you know, why don't you find like a central place, a central hub to center all of the stories. And I had noticed that in a few of them, there was a factory or like different factories around there. So that was a thought for me of just a way to have like a central place, like a spoke for, or like a hub for all these like spokes to fill out from. I think I wanted to cover, you know, a certain amount of time. And I thought, especially for Would You Rather, the first story to start, you know, just before the factory closes, to show how life was like and normality for all of the characters and, you know, the things that they all wanted to do. And especially Jack and Jess are like planning for like a future together, but that future is entirely dependent upon this job that they have. And yeah, after that, I think I just wanted to examine a bunch of different voices on a timeline over the next 7 years. And yeah, I think that one of the challenges for me, I think in terms of ordering, I think for me, once the collection hits the title story, You're in the Wrong Place, it gets pretty intense and pretty sad, I think, for almost the rest of the book. And I was kind of concerned about not having enough levity or comic relief. The only story in there from my take on it that I think is just purely funny is probably Exit Stage Left. And that's the story that precedes You're in the Wrong Place. But I think that was kind of I like personally the kind of like the arc of tension that builds after the title story. And I did want that to kind of like lead into a cathartic moment in The Slow Death, which is like the second to last story. So I was, I think, thinking about that arc while I was constructing it. But also, yeah, I was kind of concerned that there probably wasn't enough, you know, funny or funny-ish things in here in terms of the ordering.
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, when you're reconstructing from life or you're trying to capture a certain time period, if mm-hmm. there wasn't much levity at that time, mm-hmm. it's hard to create it, right. You know, it's a serious story. Okay, let's go to Jack. So it starts out, you have this long paragraph in the beginning of Jack where it's his 21st birthday, and it sort of runs through the names of everybody who was there and the shots they did. And, you know, it's just like a really fun night. There's some Jägermeister involved. And I'm just curious about your idea of starting the story with that scene in particular.
Yeah, I wanted to introduce all of the narrators or the people who would introduce the narrators in a indirect way. Charlie Baxter, who was one of my professors at Minnesota, I think I worked especially with him on this idea and gleaned from his workshops that you don't always have to approach something that you want to do or say, especially in terms of a premise. You don't have to approach it directly. You can kind of be a little evasive in that way. So I was thinking of a way, I think, especially with this story, it's like, okay, well, how can I clue the reader into who is going to be telling the rest of this story, but not, you know, kind of force it down their throats to be like, this is the structure of the book. And, you know, like this is what it's going to look like. And this is what all these people are like going to sound and talk like. So I thought that having, you know, like this situation where it's a celebration, you know, in the book after this story is going to get, you know, pretty intense and pretty sad. So to start with, you know, showcasing this like slice of life when things were, you know, better, things were good and things were hopeful, and, you know, having the rest of the narrator showcase their own personalities in terms of, you know, the shots that they buy Jack, the narrator, that night while they're celebrating, I thought was a pretty interesting way to kind of start and introduce the premise of the book.
I thought so too. So then Jess and Jack have this little running thing of would you rather, right? And we get the first one a few more paragraphs in, would you rather have ice or no ice? And then it just keeps rolling throughout the story. And I'm just wondering how you came up with that motif for their relationship.
Yeah, great question. I think in some of the other stories in here, in the story Devil's Night, it's the homework assignment that they're social studies teacher gives them, that's kind of this like recurring motif. And in the story Memorial, there's a stray cat and there's the tornado siren in You're in the Wrong Place, the title story. Obviously, like that's like a joke that they keep telling each other that gets like very not funny by the end of the story. And so I kind of was like playing with the idea of motifs around most of these stories. And I thought that that would be, for me, at least when I was writing all these, I was still kind of like learning how to write short stories. And motifs for me, and especially with this book, were really helpful in terms of construction, because it kind of, it becomes, you know, this like thing that you can constantly circle back to as a writer. If you're at a point where you think that you're losing momentum, you can drop the phrase in, you can drop the motif in, and then you can kind of continue to build or braid the narrative. And I think I have a twin sister, and I think this is like a game that we used to play like in the car on the way up north when we were going up north on vacation as kids, like, would you rather do this? Would you rather do that? Like, da, 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 da. And it like just drove our parents insane. And I think when I was looking for a motif for this particular story, like that's one of the things that I thought of. And I think especially that particular phrase, would you rather, is something that you can do a lot with as a writer. It can start as something playful as it does here. It can be something very literal where they're requesting things from each other. It can turn into something that is more of a demand. It can kind of like fluctuate with when you're kind of like reading the emotional temperature of the characters. So yeah, I think it was a good way to help me kind of like push and pull the tension of the story and I guess the relationship between those two characters.
Yeah, I think that it really highlights when Jess sort of moves beyond him, and when she starts asking the bigger questions, mm-hmm. it really helps to draw that out, because I think there's a moment where she asks a question about materialism or something with would you rather involved in that, and I guess I'll find that when we get further into the story, but I thought it was a great motif, actually. I think I have page 4 here. Would you rather have the crocodile or the jaguar, he asked. That's an alligator, she said. How can you tell, I asked. It's tiny. Alligators are tiny crocs. I never knew that, Jack says. Mm-hmm. And so like, it's just the first part of sort of this disintegration of, I mean, it's not really a disintegration of their relationship at that point, but I think it's where he realizes that she's sort of beyond him in some ways. She's mm-hmm. thinking about things that he's not pondering yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Now, before I move on from page 4, is there actually a Hazel Park Carnival? I haven't been to that.
It's fantastic. It's great. It's not very big and it doesn't last very long, but they obviously had to cancel it last year, and I'm hoping they won't cancel it this year, but it's like a month away. Yeah, it's
fun.
It is in Green Acres Park over Memorial Day weekend and is a blast. It's a lot of fun. So I definitely recommend for you and all the listeners here, if you're looking for something to do over Memorial Day weekend, I definitely recommend it.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so at the bottom of page 4, Jack tells Jess his philosophy, which he says, I told her what passed is my philosophy, that things work themselves out if you give them time and space. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it just seems so sad that he says that in the first story and then you read the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm. I think that this kind of like personal philosophy, and I don't want to say like a slacker philosophy, but I think it was a philosophy that at least, you know, like I had, and a lot of people that I knew had before the recession happened in Detroit, that, you know, is as long as you're working, or, you know, as long as you can work, as long as you're kind of like open to the idea and open to the possibilities of like work and the things that surround that, then things will probably work out. Like, you'll be okay, you know, like you'll meet someone that you really like, and like you'll find a job that you don't mind doing, and then you can create like a life together and all that stuff. And yeah, that after the recession happened, like that kind of thinking, if you lived here and you were my age, was no longer feasible. It just didn't work. And I think just having this kind of relaxed attitude of, you know, Jack, at least in the first part of the story, of thinking it's like, well, yeah, I'm not a big fan of working 60 hours a week, you know, like grinding like steel and aluminum with, you know, belt sanders. Like, I'm not really thrilled to be doing this, but I'm making decent money, and like I'll do something with it, or like other things will open up through this thing that I have. And I think with that, like personal things, like, yeah, things will work themselves out, and relationships will work themselves out if you just like them time. And, you know, if you don't have any money, like that time is no longer there. And that's not something that I think he knows at the beginning of the story.
Yeah, I think my dad used to say, this too shall pass. And it's like, well, but you have to survive while it's passing. So she's really at the top of page five. Jess, you know, she's super ambitious. She wants to graduate. She wants to be the first person in her family to graduate from college. And he just says that he thinks that his work is immaterial, that it's something he has to do for his, to pay for his life outside of it. So, I mean, I think that they probably, it seems like from that I was gathering, they probably would have been doomed anyway, mm-hmm. because he would have been satisfied to stay with Dynamic forevermore. Mm-hmm. And she wanted much more out of life, mm-hmm. but this just sped everything up, and they were, and probably made him realize that you kind of have to want more out of life, possibly. Do you think he realizes that at some point?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, I love that interpretation. I think one of the most rewarding things about having this out in the world is, you know, hearing all these different reactions to all of the stories. A lot of the people I talk to have, you know, have like really, really loved a certain story, or like really hated another, and like a completely, like another person will have like the completely different read on that. And I personally, I love that, you know. I think that to me, it kind of builds variety, and the fact that, you know, you're able to write like different things that touch notes with different people, I think shows like some like range for me that I'm like excited about, and I really want to build on. I think to answer your question a little more specifically, yeah, I think this is kind of like a consequence of him not planning on there being a recession, planning on this reality where there will not be any more work. And since there won't be any more work, and I think very specifically industrial work, then there will be no way to make a living, and no way to, you know, build a life with another person, like much less like a life with yourself. And I think, yeah, that obliviousness, I kind of agree, is very like tragic.
I read somewhere or heard you say that Dynamic is a fabricated business, but you did something similar for a summer, or you worked in a similar industry. Can you talk a little bit about how you wove that real life experience into the fiction?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I did off and on for 3 years. So from May of 2007, when I came home from college after my sophomore year, yeah, it was my uncle's fabricating shop in Roseville. And I think it's recently moved to Romeo. But yeah, I mean, I did. I was in deburring in the press room and doing a bunch of other like fabricating type stuff, just as general labor there for that summer. And then when I came back for the winter term. I worked there in the winter, and then the same thing the next summer and the next winter. And then when I graduated in May of 2009. And that was, you know, I think probably like the yikes moment here in terms of employment, especially for recent college grads with an English degree. Yeah. So I worked there for 6 months after that, and then moved to Ann Arbor and tried to like find like a steady job there for, I want to say like 7 or 8 months, and then came back and worked again. This would have been, I think, summer of 2010 for the next like 6 months there. So, and honestly, you know, like looking back on it, I know hindsight is 2020, but you know, they did have opportunities there for if you wanted to, you know, go to night class and learn welding, or, you know, like learn machining, how to program some of the machines that drill like really specific holes in certain parts of the production cycle. Maybe something that I should have taken advantage of, because I mean, I could have probably stayed there kind of as long as I wanted, and I probably would own a house by now and, you know, have like a nice little nest egg that I could continue with. The only problem was the how early it was. It was 5:30 to 4 Monday through Friday, and then it was like 5:30 to noon or 1 every other Saturday. It's a lot of work. You make like a lot of, I still have never made that much money in my life, you know, working this like factory job from over 10 years ago now. But I'm not a morning person, and getting up at 5 o'clock and working like 10 or 11 hours a day, like I had no time to write. I like couldn't do it. So if there was some way that I could have, you know, been able to fit in 2 hours a day of writing, or randomly take some like days off, which you can't do in the manufacturing job. Like when you're there, like you have to work, like you have to do your job. Yeah. I mean, it was, in terms of an economic path for me, was far more viable than I found in, you know, the writing world that, you know, we're both in now. You know, it's kind of tough. So
yeah. There's no money to be made. That's
And I did meet some, like, I met some really, really interesting people, and had some just awesome conversations. It is a completely different working environment and dynamic than you would have, you know, in the academy, you know, where I was when I was at Minnesota, or at, you know, all the other like office jobs that I have. You know, it's a much different repartee that you have with each other when you're all working that hard. So yeah, a great experience.
So how did you come up with the name of the company, Dynamic, which I think is so perfect in so many ways?
Yeah, I think that just going around Detroit, there's the title like Dynamic in a lot of the manufacturing places. I know that a good chunk of the manufacturing that's done here revolves around the auto industry, and that is kind of like a vaguely automotive term, which I think it's used so much here. I don't know if I've pulled up like the exact definition of dynamic, but it's something that's kind of like in motion, changeable. And I thought it was just like, well, yeah, thematically that fits like really, really well, especially when that's removed and everything in the book is kind of in this state of stasis that nobody really wants to be in.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. It was perfect. So on the bottom of page 7, going back to the religious theme, they start talking about they're going up on I-75 to get away, to get out of town. And he asks, which apostle would you rather follow? Which I thought was really interesting switch, because I wasn't thinking about him as the type of guy who would ask a question like that. So I was kind of pleasantly surprised, mm-hmm. because she seemed to have all of those deep thoughts, but they weren't together for no reason. So mm-hmm. And I don't know anything about, like, so this conversation kind of went over my head, the difference between James and Peter and Paul. But go ahead. You tell me what you were thinking there.
Oh, yeah. I think that obviously, you know, anyone who lives in Detroit that goes up to northern Michigan, whether you're going to Lake Huron or to Lake Michigan, you always pass the Dixie Baptist Church in Clarkston, and there is like really like an enormous painting of Jesus kind of like lifted up there. And so for a long time, I've always said to myself, I got to fit that in a story somehow or something that I write. And yeah, I thought that that would be a good way to segue into a different discussion they were having, as you said. So like seeing this giant portrait would be just something to comment on, because I always comment on it if I'm ever going up north with anyone. And I guess for my understanding, I was raised Presbyterian, but I went to Catholic school for a year, which I think is what kind of made me irreligious. I think just like having my grade in a class determined on believing something that was in my mind then kind of abstract. And I think that's kind of what like started my like disassociation from real, I guess, authentic belief. But yeah, I always thought that the biblical figure of Paul was interesting, like having someone that was a persecutor, like all of a sudden become like the, you know, the leader and, you know, like main apostle of this like nascent belief. That is just generally, I think, a really interesting story. Peter, like, I guess I'm not as familiar with, because, you know, when you're raised, I was raised as a Presbyterian, there is not so much focus on the apostles, especially as holy figures, because in Protestantism, at least in Presbyterianism, like you don't really believe in the saints as holy figures. It's basically just, you know, God and Jesus. But Peter was Jesus's like hand person, his best friend, the person that Jesus chose, at least in one of the Gospels, as the person to, you know, go to Rome and, you know, sacrifice himself and start the church. And yeah, I don't know. I think that that contrast for me, just in terms of a story, if even if you just want to read the Bible as a story, that's a really interesting contrast, like someone who persecutes and someone who is deciding on their own to be a martyr for this cause. And like that, those are two very different ways to kind of like approach your, I don't know, I don't want to say like destiny, but, you know, go forward in what you believe in. Like, that's a really, really interesting contrast. And those two are like two of the most important figures in the story of, you know, the spreading of Christianity, whether that's, you know, actually true or not.
Okay. Then she goes into, then they start talking about materialism. And you talked a little bit about it in the beginning, but basically the idea is what, that physical matter is the only fundamental reality, as you say, mm-hmm. right? So that you can't hang on to anything that is intangible. There is nothing that is intangible. Is exactly. that the bottom line? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so where did that come from for you?
I think that was kind of the main thing that I was thinking about while I was writing it, and something that I've been thinking about for a long time. That materialism to me, I think, makes the most sense on a rational level. It's not something that I necessarily enjoy believing in, because if you do believe in materialism, that there are just like a finite amount of elements, and like that's what makes up our bodies, and I think specifically our brains, and like, you know, the different chemical reactions in our brains is, you know, like what triggers everything that we think and what we love and what we believe. And there's nothing really deeper than that. And I think more to the point, if that is all true, then, you know, there is no, you know, cosmic meaning or, you know, central focus of our love and our desires, and that it's truly up to us to, you know, make meaning out of lives and to give our lives purpose. And I think especially for me, in the economy that has kind of developed as I've grown up, all of that possibility of making your own way and making your own life, like, you know, like the existentialists wrote about, that's all completely determined about how much money you have. Because you can say like, I'm in charge of my destiny, and like, that's really liberating, but if you don't have a job and like you don't have any money, then you're not free at all. Like you have to, you know, do any kind of work that you can get, regardless if that work gives your life purpose. Like you just have to do it to pay for your essentials, you know, your material needs. You know, you have to work to buy clothes to warm yourself and to buy food to feed yourself, and you gotta work to pay for rent so you're not out in the cold. You gotta, you know, pay to get to and from your job and transportation. And it's just like, those are all like material needs that we all need. No one is exempt from any of those. Those are necessities. And yeah, I think that contrast of having this ideology that is on its surface really liberating, but when applied to our certain economic situation now, and particularly during the recession, where all of that is completely taken away, then you are kind of stuck, because it's hard to go back to, and it was hard for me at least, to go back to believing it's something like, once you've disproved it, if materialism disproves that there is this, you know, cosmic theological nature to everything that connects us all. If you no longer believe that, and you've convinced yourself of that, you know, because of your belief in materialism, you can't go back to that comfort. So you're kind of like stuck in this area. And for me, at least, materialism, even though I do believe it, it is very difficult when applied to death, because death, if you believe in materialism, is a catastrophe. Because, you know, if it takes someone that you love, you know, I've heard just like, well, you can, you know, keep them alive in you and, you know, continue their memory if you can, but they're not physically there. They're not materially there. It's just this like gnawing absence that you have until you die. And like, that's just also like approaching your own death. It's just like, what does materialism give you for your own death? It's like, you're going to not exist and completely disappear, which to me is terrifying. I think, like Nietzsche said, that's the most troubling thought. There's no like comfort for you when you get sick or as you reach the end. So it's a tough thing to believe, but at the same time, if you're not a religious person, it's hard to go back, because then it's just kind of cynical, I guess. And I guess that's something that I just wanted to try to like sketch out in like a very rudimentary way in the story between these two characters, because it's something that everyone else in the collection faces on this kind of like philosophical level.
Yeah. And it's so fascinating. Of course, they can't come to any conclusion. Like, there's this one point where they're doing the would you rather at the bottom of page 12, you know, and then she's like, no, do you believe it or not? And then I pulled her close, resting my chin on her shoulder, believe what? And then she doesn't want to go, you know, like, then she's like, okay, forget it. We're not going to do this. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. Like, then they go into dynamic when they get back, and obviously you know, it's going to be closed down. And the boss came down from upstairs, and he explains that some investment bank in New York, you know, wasn't bailed out, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, if any of you are religious, now would be the time to pray. And of course, you know, that is like a theme that could run forevermore, because, you know, even if you believe completely in materialism, you're always looking for or hoping for some sign that you're wrong.
Exactly. And
that you can go exactly. Back. Yes. Yeah, I want to go back.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. But a lot of harm is done by the believers who think they know exactly what you're supposed to be doing next. So that's not good either. I feel like there's a happy medium somewhere. I'm not sure where it is. Okay, I don't want to keep you all day. I thought it was nice the way that you wove in the fact that when the interest rates on my mortgage kicked in that fall, I lost the house too and moved back in with my parents without bringing that whole balloon rate thing in. You know, it just sort of was a fact that so many people were hurt by that as well. And what's funny is at the end of the story, he's still so young. So I did see, so he and Jess break up, and then he does see her again on his 24th birthday, which is, you know, you're still pretty young then, but I'm sure he felt and the story makes him feel as though he's completely washed up at 24, but he's not, obviously. But there was a sad moment in the bottom of page 15 where he says, "I was making small talk with the bartender when she walked in with someone else. I waited for my gut to sink, and when it didn't, I longed to feel something other than indifference." And that, and then later at the end, it was an interesting ending that leaves it a little bit open-ended, because he says, "Would you rather have a shot or a beer?" And it ends with bartender says, "Yeah, would you rather have a shot or a beer?" So I said to Jess, "What'll it be?" And so you kind of get the idea that possibly, I mean, he's not feeling anything, so I think probably not, but the story itself leaves it hanging on, well, maybe.
Yeah, I think I definitely did want that kind of ambiguousness. I think especially as it's a, it leads into the rest of the collection, because this took a long time to do. I think I did it right before my last year, my third year at Minnesota. And it's so interesting, like, I'd love to talk with you either about this, like, now or later, how you framed Garden for the Blind, because I think you did it in a really, really interesting way with that first story, in terms of everything that you were introducing and everything you were setting up, and like how you chose to kind of like leave it on the final note. And for me, I think the note that I wanted to end it on is this kind of like murky one, because everything now is uncertain. And, you know, in Would You Rather, it's this life that was built that is, you know, that no longer exists anymore. And, you know, this future that seemed so certain for both of them will never happen now. And you're kind of like entering into, they're both entering into this like brand new, you know, world without each other, like on their own, struggling to make sense of what they lost and, you know, what they even want now. It's very kind of centered in the moment on the last page. And I think that's what I wanted too. It's just like, end on this note of ambiguity, let all these other voices come in to tell their own variations on, you know, what has happened in the wake of it. And yeah, I don't think that I would have been able to write a frame story that, to me at least, was effective for the reader if I ended on something that was maybe a little more solid, if that makes any sense.
Totally. And I think that's what's one of the greatest things about interconnected stories, or, you know, novel and stories or whatever, is that you have that, you have the concentration of the short story, but then you also know that it's working within a larger framework. And so you can come back to those themes over and over again, which you did an amazing job of in this book. So I am going to end this so that I don't keep you all afternoon, but I really, really appreciate you talking to me about the story. And everybody should go out and buy the book. I'll have a link in the chat box below. And thank you so much for being here today.